Rose is your name, but when you poop, it sure don't smell like roses. Your number two burns the hair in my nose, but we fought hand in paw. Now your poop don't stink at all. Now that the air is clear, I'll treasure your front and rear, my sweet rose.
Instantly neutralize poop stink with Poop Fighter from World's Best Cat Litter for the world's best cat.
Welcome to Come to the Brink. I'm Zoe Flowers, and this is a space for those of us navigating profound life changes like loss, trauma, caregiving, and transformation. It's about what happens when everything you thought was solid crumbles beneath you and you're forced to rebuild. If you've ever felt like you're standing on the brink, this is the space for you. Welcome.
We should have imagined life as created in the birth pain of God, the mother. Then we would understand that. We would know that our life's rhythms beats from her great heart, torn with agony of love and birth. Then we would understand why we, her children, have inherited pain, and we would feel that death meant a reunion with her, a passing back into her substance, the blood of her blood again, piece of her peace. Human females and males are not equal genetic parents. The female X chromosome is 3 to 4 times longer than the male Y chromosome. It carries the overwhelming preponderance of critical genetic information unrelated to sex needed to create a human being. Further, while only half of the population has a Y chromosome, all of us, female and male, contain an X. It is our primary genetic bond and species. This new male god must be enforced on people by the punitive and guilt-projecting ideologies of a privileged priesthood. In their writings and doctrine flooding the Bronze Age, creation now comes to be seen as evil. The creator is above and apart from his creation, and while he is perfect, the world is flawed. And so the idea of original sin can be conceived for the first time to rationalize the unnatural new relation between the human soul and the aloof God. This layers the basis for all further alienated relationships between people and God, between people and people, between people and the natural world, between rulers and the rule. For now, the primary relation is not that we share the same divine substance, but that we share the same material corruption. And the entire priesthood exists to redeem us from the sin of being born from the mother, and to rationalize class disparity by preaching that the new class system is God's design, his method for creating civilized order out of the corruption and chaos of human flesh. For an unjust system to work for any prolonged period of time, it is necessary that the masses of people believe they deserve injustice. So we've diverged from the Women Who Run With the Wolves reading that we've been doing for weeks now, and we've moved to the Great Cosmic Mother, Rediscovering the Religion of Earth by Monica Sue and Barbara Moore. And I feel like that reading was absolutely perfect for my guest and friend that I have on today. So welcome, welcome back to Come to the Brink with Zoe Flowers. And today's conversation is going to be a journey through grief, trauma, and dare I say, reclaiming what we've forgotten. Through spiritual awakening and deep healing. My guest is the inspiring Amy Miranda. She is an entrepreneur, activist, shamanic practitioner, and award-winning executive producer. Known for her powerful, connective gifts, Amy is the founder of Lunch, an author and a healer committed to guiding others through both spiritual and creative pathways. So today we're going to explore some of her early experiences, on the impact of unhealed trauma, and her transformative spiritual journey, and how grief opened portals to new healing and purpose, and obviously anything else that she wants to talk about.
Thank you.
So welcome, Amy.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so glad you're here.
Me too.
So how are you arriving today? How are you arriving this morning?
I'm arriving on the heels of taking some downtime, being in airplane mode, so which I highly recommend to everyone. I think we live in a society that's ruled by devices and notifications, and so I put that down for about 4 days, and it's also a really great reflection on how much time we spend on screens. By putting that down. But and the one thing I want to say, I didn't miss it. I didn't miss it. And I think that's the thing, right? Is coming back into that sort of wired. We're also coming off the heels of a Canadian long weekend, so I did it in tandem. But I think this idea of, taking time and going to the desert, so to speak, is something that we all should be doing more often. So, yeah, coming back out of that in divine reflection and purpose, I think. A little more slow moving, which I think is good. I've been practicing a lot of snail medicine lately.
Well, I think it's so interesting again that, and we this was our call before the call, folks, that you went offline right around the time that I started reading from your deck what we've forgotten for my Instagram live readings. So I started working with your deck last Tuesday, inspired by Monday's full moon in Scorpio, and sort of using your deck as a jump off to the rest of the reading. So it's kind of like you were like, I'm out of here for a while. And I was like, no, you're not.
I love that. I especially love that about printed works. For a lot of my career, I produced things that were like digital and in the ether, and I think that's the beauty of like having a printed work is that you're actually like engaging with people on a consciousness level, right? Of whether I'm online or not. And I think that's the thing for all of us creators, authors. We spend a lot of time, right, promoting our work. And I think that's the beauty of it, right? Is it being reminded that it'll pick itself up and the right people will find it, right?
At the right time.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So, let's begin at the beginning about like young Amy. What was young Amy like? Were you always creative? How would you describe yourself? What did you what like to get up? What did you We know each other, folks, but we're gonna pretend that we don't for you all.
Yeah, I mean, I was a creative kid. My grandmother was an artist, and she, for most of you are probably not going to be seeing it, but there's a painting behind me that she did late into her 80s. It's a John William Waterhouse painting. It's called The Magic Circle. So I grew up with creatrixes around me. My family was very creative, but no one had really made it into a career other than men. Men had a good, but the women, it was sort of a hidden talent for most of us. I mean, my grandmother definitely showed her work, and but it was not something that was ever sort of represented to me that could be a career, let alone healing work. So there was always a mix of both in my family. There was the conversations around the dinner table where, after dinner, family dinners, there'd be like a select group that stayed and talked about inspiration, experiences, divinity. And of course, as a kid, my family talked about, that they spoke to angels or. And I would always name it like, as a kid, the word I had for it was we're witches.
You would
And
say that out loud?
oh yeah. And of
Oh
course,
my
I always I most that's the irony, I think, of part of my story is I spent a lot of time saying the quiet part out loud, and then, eventually it was like, when will the fire be? Because I hadn't said my quiet part out loud. But I was good at, pointing it out for others. I still am, I think. Maybe a little bit more elegantly now that I'm older. But when I was a kid, I definitely, called it like it was, and I thought that they were doing some pretty, amazing magic. And I had imaginary friends.
Okay.
I had always lived in multiple realities, and there was always like a self-policing element Women who run with wolves, that was sort of there as a protection element, where there were certain things I didn't share, even with, my mom and my grandmother, my great grandmother, who were always talking about, spiritually led experiences. And my great great grandfather was a circuit preacher. So there was a lot of like traditional
A what preacher?
circuit preacher. So he would
Ah.
go from like town to town and do like, I think what were like revivals.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of history of like speaking the good word, but we did not really talk about magic. So as I was growing up, the magic that I found was through, hanging out with my best friend who I met when I was two, and really creating a world of enchantment together and, putting things together and sort of escaping, I think, what was going on in our, ordinary reality of being a child in the 80s, which was, I mean, now we're seeing, kids have autonomy and agency. I grew up in a time where, it was get in the car and, we don't really have time to talk about your feelings. So there was a lot of time as a kid where I spent in creative mode, where I was like in, inventing realities and, in sort of communion with my best friend. So there was definitely a lot of adult stuff going on in my childhood. I think my reaction to it was to seek enchantment. So I was always interested in that, but definitely was still in the witch wound.
Yeah,
I
for
needed
sure.
a safe place to inhabit.
Yeah. I feel like we're very similar in that upbringing. I think the 80s and late 70s, early 80s in particular was really interesting, right? Because it was still very much children should be seen and not heard. But then there was also all of these times that are, at least my parents didn't know what I was getting up to, you know? I would just like, I'd get on my bike and I'd be in the forest somewhere, like with my friends, and we would literally be gone for hours. Just out in the world. And I think that there is something magical about that time. And also as adults looking back, it's like, damn. Like, they really,
Danger.
what were they doing? I guess they were living their lives. They were
Well,
doing.
and I think they were in their own, I mean, I think, my parents' generation, I mean, they were in their own trauma. I mean, my
Yeah,
father,
100%.
Vietnam, as far as we know.
Yeah.
And my mom, grew up in her own trauma, and I think that was where, a lot of people had kids because that was what you did next. So and I think, obviously there's an element of love to having children, but I think people during that time, it was like there was that sort of in, especially in the, as you said, the late 70s, early 80s, where there was this, sense of, the American dream, right? Of like, here's what you do, and here, you have
For
pets,
sure.
kids, and you move to a subdivision. And then of course it's like, when will the existential crisis be? So, and in my childhood, the existential crisis was, my parents realizing that they shouldn't be married, and then us going through the vortex of figuring out what a single mom look like in the 80s, which was not a time where it was easy for women to, get gainful employment and all of those things. So I think a lot of us kids, especially who came from, broken homes, 80s after school special with the, the key around our necks, which actually an
Around our
advertisement
neck.
that we were going home alone, right? It's like, hello everyone, we're going home alone. But I think there was that sense of in the 80s of us as the children of a lot of, single moms who we found our own way. And as you said, like we're in the woods or after school on our own, getting up to whatever we were getting up to. But I also think that created this like autonomy and
I do
agency
too.
that we didn't necessarily have before. And I mean, my trajectory of growing up and having this like best friend that I could confide in.
Yes.
Unfortunately, that's where, my story turns, is I mean, she died in a car accident 2 days before my 19th birthday. So my reaction to that was not to recognize, because I had, grown up in the rave scene and I had always been very creative and, got interested in drugs as soon as they were available to me and never had really named what had driven that until my best friend had passed away. And that was where I had sort of realized, okay, things are pretty serious for me. And my reaction and response to losing this, cohort who we sort of spoke the same language. And then I was sort of, found myself surrounded by aliens, which were my parents and, my family in some ways by that point, and pursuing business, right? Before I decided to, open the hood and look at what was going on before she passed away, because there was trauma. And, I hadn't named it because, again, it was the 80s and people were a lot, people were in a lot more deep water than me, I thought. So,
You were 19.
I was 19. Yeah, when she, I was, it was 2 days before my 19th birthday. So I went to her funeral on my 19th birthday.
And so, how did you start to process that? Like, how did you start to address and process that? Was it years later?
Oh, yeah. I think now we know that, when something like this happens, that it's a meteorite hitting your life. It's catastrophic. And we know now to do something. My reaction then was, I'm gonna, I mean, I had a ton of survivor's guilt. I had already been in a car accident where I shouldn't have walked away. She had died in a car accident 6 months later. And so there was this, there was breadcrumbs, there was patterns to where the road was headed if I didn't change something.
I see.
And the way that I had sort of measured up when she left was, because I didn't really have a lot of authentic power at that time, I saw it as it should have been me. The universe fucked up. I was now going to prove myself. So that was sort of where the thinking went. It wasn't about, that I had already had what in shamanic circles we call soul loss, that I had already been dealing with trauma. I saw it as I have to make her proud of me. And I've got to show everyone who's left, her family, my family, that this wasn't a mistake.
So everything went into work. Work
So
money.
I basically started, and I put that to work in a very, 80s way.
80s way.
Where I was like, put on the shoulder pads, let's do the business. So, and that was, I mean, it was the late 90s by that point, but I was working in tech and I ended up, I started my career at CNN and was doing some incredible work. I was a manager of, I laugh because it's IT was what everyone thought the internet was back then, but I was a manager of IT by the time I was 23 years old. And so on paper I did it, but I had done no trauma recovery and I had done no, I mean, I had written letters. I had, the interesting part was I had been in communication with her since she left. So I was trying to rationalize having this, I had imaginary friends and then I had a real friend whose voice turned into an imaginary friend and trying to rationalize A, how I was worthy of having that, and B, having to figure out how to explain that to people who are close to me, and also starting to walk the path with her family of talking about it because it wasn't just me that it was happening to, and starting to honor sort of the richness of my best friend Aaron's spirit And I knew that I needed to write about it. I knew I was going to write about it, but I think with a lot of, again, that sort of 80s, approach to grief was, that's later. We'll do that later. It was always like, we'll handle it later. And I think, I got to a point where, the decision was made for me, and I had, a breakdown and realized that I needed to do some serious soul searching. And that was where spirituality, found me.
Did you have any, thank you for sharing that. Did you have any other human guides at that point, or were you solely like led and surrounded by spirit to like take you on this path?
That's a great question. I had always been surrounded by spirits more so than human teachers. And I think, I mean, now looking back, I wasn't looking for a human teacher then. I think I always felt on some level, even as a kid, that humans didn't really know what they were doing. With all due respect to humans, I always sort of felt like there was probably something that we were missing. And I think because I had such a rich life and consciousness, I assumed that that was where I was going to get the answers. And I also, through, I think getting to that point where I knew I needed a human teacher. I had sought, in terms of like grief and starting to deal with it, was probably about 20, 15, 20 years later that I finally was like, okay, I need to deal with the grief of losing my best friend. And I had had other losses since then, but not the same. I mean, she and I were just two peas in a pod. So it was, I think, I didn't take the time. And then, as what happens when you're human and you don't take the time, you get forced to take the time.
Of course.
So I, through a series of amazing synchronicities that I talk about in my book, I met a human teacher who still is my teacher, a man named Daniel Leonard. And I saw him for ceremony. I had been seeing, I talk about mind, body, spirit, and I had been doing the mental stuff. I'd been going to therapy. I'd been doing the body. I was starting to do. I mean, I was at the point where I couldn't even have a massage. People knew not to touch me. I was very prickly as a person. I was a cactus of a person. My mom still says I was the angriest person she had ever met. And I knew that there needed to be some kind of processing. And I knew that the processing that I hadn't done was energetic.
You were hearing it. It's so something that you were talking about, like not like having this sense that humans haven't quite figured it out. And you also talked about being between worlds. I'm curious if you ever got glimpses of like a past life during that time or a future life, if you could talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. So when my best friend passed away, my mom did what I think a lot of witch moms do. Instead of taking, when your kid starts to, hear voices, instead of taking them to the doctor, you take them to a clairvoyant. She took me to a clairvoyant that she'd been seeing for years, an amazing, incredible woman who's since passed. But she, we sat together, and she was really the first person that I was able to speak openly with about what was really going on. And she was the first person, she's probably like my first human teacher, who showed up and said that there was nothing negative about what I was capable of, and talked to me about past life stuff. And again, I was, just turned 19. And she had told me that I was going to write a book that would change the way people think. And of course, I was in deep grief, and I thought, okay, yeah, that's great. Good. Thanks for telling me that. Is my best friend okay? That was really all I needed. And I had been up at night after she had passed away, and she kept telling me to write, my best friend. She kept saying, write. And I thought, what do you want me to write? So getting that, those breadcrumbs, those dots connected by a clairvoyant and someone assuring me that, and at that point, that which was, I think, the beginning of my, spiritual journey, was, that psychic had said she wants you to walk her forward, meaning my best friend wanted me to be the one to walk her forward into transition. Which for me, I mean, A, I did it because she asked me to do it, and I wasn't going to disappoint her any further than I already felt that I had. And the second part of that was it was the first time that I had sort of been reminded of skills that I had as a soul versus as a person. Because I was 19, I had no experience with that doing any of that. I didn't, I mean, but from the moment I arrived on this planet, I was, you know, I one of the first things I talked about with my mom when I could talk was that I had heard, you know, her heartbeat. I remembered being in the womb. So there was always breadcrumbs of things that I had encountered as a very little kid. And then it sort of, you know, I think I muted it with drugs and alcohol. And then it carried me through the moments where I couldn't carry myself.
Spirit.
Spirit, yeah,
Spirituality.
spirituality, energy, my soul, yeah. So I think that was where, so by the time I ended up realizing I needed energetic assistance, it was me sort of thinking about what I had been through throughout time as a soul from like a 10,000 foot view, and realizing that there was meaning to the grief and that there was a foundation that I was coming with, that I was becoming a translator of grief for other people, even though I wasn't sitting in that seat. I mean, I was an executive producer by that point. So it wasn't a place where I was integrating in a way that I do now, where I was talking about, you know, being between worlds. The close people in my life knew that wasn't something that was safe to say publicly, at least in my own mind. So walking that path of starting to weave together the past life experiences and the understanding of walking a soul forward, what is called psychopomp, working with transitioning souls, doing these things. It was a remembering where I started to be able to really call it what it was, which was a remembering.
Do you think that grief you were in helped you to do that work in any way?
100%. I think grief shadow work is a brilliant facilitator. I think if we think about, we're going to get, you know, turn up the dial to 11 on the woo meter. If we're going to be going there, this idea of that we come to this planet and that this planet Earth is like a school where our souls have the opportunity to grow, change, just like, you know, a plant or a tree. And we are intentional in that growth, that when we're here, we can make big strides in terms of our capacity for remembering, for change, for connecting the dots, and sort of going back to that idea of humans, you know, there's been some great publishing work throughout history about the idea that we walk between worlds. I mean, whether Quran, with the night journey of Muhammad going between worlds, and it, of course, called journey, which was a great clue for us, that shamanic journey. Or, you know, the Bible talking about the transfiguration, where there's moments of, you know, spirit coming through, where there was people having visions. I started to, through my teacher, Daniel Leonard, and processing the grief and intentionally processing the grief and coming at it with the knowledge that it is a teacher and that grief is a phenomenal teacher. And that was where, in working with my teacher, I was able to, you know, work through the grief around losing my best friend, but then also work around the grief of losing my childhood, which was finally naming my own abuse and trauma and trigger warning. You know, I was sexually abused by my father. So starting to look at the grief from a real origin story perspective, for me, in order to process the things that I had survived, I needed to look much, much deeper than what had occurred in this lifetime. So the grief became a teacher in that. And I think this is where a lot of people stop the grief work. And I always say this is where it begins, is looking at why, right? What is my, what's my soul's journey? What's the purpose of this? What's the, connection to past lives? And when I went after my father, and I finally sought justice, of course, he threatened me, as abusers do, but he said that I had awoken something primordial in him. And my abuser doesn't talk like that. So it was a very big indicator to me from throughout space and time that all of the work that I had done on the origin of the relationship, the origin of the grief, the origin of my purpose on the planet in this incarnation right now, it was a big check mark for me that I was following exactly the right path, because he was reflecting that it was something old. And I think, that kind of trauma does come from an ancient source. So it was a very, I think the energy work, spiritual work, past life work provides the foundation and the depth of roots required to be able to deal with this kind of bottom and this kind of grieving. Because grieving comes not only through, death and loss, but it comes through, the death and loss of parts of ourselves, not just people that are outside of ourselves. And then that idea of the phoenix rising from the ashes, which I had been through that with my best friend. I had been through the transmutation of losing her being, a completely gutting, tectonic plate shifting experience, to seeing meaning, to being given guidance, to meeting her nephew, who is named after her and is very much, I talk about in the book, very much like her, to be able to witness that and to witness the rebirth out of the death. And I think that's the part where a lot of people, when they're grieving, they get caught in the shadow. And I think, I'm always a big alchemist, and I like to remind people that shadow exists because of light. There is no shadow without light. So, and the idea of a fog, people talk about, especially when I'm working with people in grief in my practice, talk about being in that fog. And I mean, the fog is removed in nature by sunlight, by heat. So, and I think that's the same with spiritual light. When we put spiritual light or energy on a situation, when we're witnessed by a human being or a human teacher, which again, that was written in a lot of these old publications, the idea of being witnessed to move us through and to almost create this, like, zip line through space and time where we can pull ourselves out of that shadow and back into the illumination, and to share, which I think is what a lot of us, are learning to do in grief, is to talk about it, to honor the spirit of, that not only has, been in our lives, but that moved through us as they departed and transitioned. And I do a lot of death work and working with people before and after transition. And the magic that exists of being in those holy places and sacred spaces, and showing up for people to be able to help them, I think sometimes rationalize what they've experienced. A miracle of being in a situation where a soul passes. I had a friend a few weeks ago who lost her father, and she was in the room. And it was her first time being in the room when someone passed. And we just talked about the effects on your physical body after that happens, because there is an electric charge that happens. Really looking, I think, at the science of the grief, and looking at, where the meaning comes from out of the depths of those moments of shadow.
Can you talk a little bit about this electrical charge? Because I was present when my friend Peggy passed, myself and four other girlfriends. And then, of course, I was present when my mom passed last year. And I, this is the first time I'm hearing about this electrical spark.
So, in my experience, and I think, souls choose who they want in the room. There's bedsides I've been to where people were told to get out. So, my grandfather was one of those bedsides. That's why I laugh. So the idea of death, the idea of a soul leaving the body, it's almost like, and the image that spirit's telling me to give right now is the idea of landing on an aircraft carrier. Plane has to catch the hook. So that's what happens when we're born. The plane hooks into, so that's what they're showing me as an analogy. And to die, we're doing the reverse. We got to take off. A lot of people, when they start to, and this is around people who are going through either hospice or going through transition, accidents obviously are different. Again, still divinely timed. But the idea of someone being in a palliative state or hospice state and transitioning, a lot of times there's time for people to be in the room and hold vigil. Which is rare because we don't do this very often these days. When we do that, if you look throughout history, when that happens, there's ceremony after because it's the living who are processing the miracle that has transpired, which is being able to, and I always say this with my clients, it when you're in the room at a passing, you're essentially handing this soul back to source. In love. So there's an unbroken current. Because the current's unbroken, especially if you're holding a hand or you're in the room, you're going to feel that jet take off. Just like with a birth, you feel it, it's emotional, the birth, the soul is hit the it's hit the air. The reverse is we're around a plane taking off. So it's going to jiggle your nervous system. There's going to be a vibration and a current as the force. I'm a Star Wars person, but as the force, the light force leaves the body. So the time of grieving following a death is designed because that's how it used to be, was that everyone was there. And then we would grieve together because our nervous systems need to recalibrate, which is why there was food, celebration, song. So this idea of, and again, Amy Miranda doesn't know this. This is soul knowledge, right? I just got here. But this idea of being able to witness the miracle of the transition, both in physical but also in spiritual reality. So that's where, prayer, gathering, those things came from. But part of the way that I work with clients to grieve is getting them communicating in spirit where the majority of the energy of those departed people live. Because while they were on the aircraft carrier, we were living in ordinary reality the majority of the time. When we're off the aircraft carrier, we're transmitting through vibration, through sound, through pen and a pad, those ideas of actually being able to transmute our feelings into vibrations. And I think that's where the energetic piece of death. A lot of people don't talk about it because it's such a holy, sacred thing, and it's sort of the last thing you want to do is relive that experience. But the holiness of actually transmuting the energy and opening up that field, so to speak, to be able to process the holiness and sacredness of a miracle that is someone leaving their body.
Absolutely. I, In the sort of 2 weeks that my mom was like in that nonverbal state where I think she probably was deciding, like, okay, like, am I gonna try to like stay and like thug this thing out, or am I gonna just go to where I said I wanted to go anyway? I was looking for a death doula. Like right up until like a couple days before she died, I was like calling people and like sending texts and being like, oh, I need a death doula. Meanwhile, I'm sitting there every day next to her, playing music, right? The music from her time. I was like, oh, girl, you the death doula. You are the unwilling death doula.
What a divine appointment.
It was. I mean, I had to get to that.
Oh, of course. Yeah, of course.
That was
Really,
like,
I'd
oh.
rather engage someone to do this, you know? Yeah.
Let me find somebody. Like one of my friends was like, well, I can kind of come in on a bus to do it. I was like, girl, she gone. She gone.
Well, in the soul agreement, right, of it being you, and I think the music, right? Like, I mean, this the hearing is the last sense to go.
Yeah.
I don't think it ever goes. I think they always can hear. I mean, based on
Oh,
my
yeah.
experience, right, and yours. I
Oh,
mean,
yeah.
I, you know, hearing never goes. I think they can
Oh,
always.
no. I mean, yeah, when I was setting up my ancestor altar years ago, I don't know if I ever told you this story. I'm into like African things. So I put on some Orisha music and put some wine on the altar. And they were like, girl, what is this? We listen to Gladys Knight and we drink gin and rum. You drink wine. We do not. And I really thought I was doing something. I'm dancing, I'm doing my African dance in front of the altar. It's like, girl, what you doing? That's what you like. They're like, no shade, but like, I'm born in 1941. What are you doing?
Exactly. Well, and it's not their vibration,
It's
right?
not,
It's not their
I don't know what
vibration.
that
I'm like, what
is.
channel is that?
What is that? Put on something we like. Give us what we like. So yes, they listen and they talk.
Yes. And I think the community of spirit, right? Like the community of what happens when a spirit who is in our lives and, you know, we have a current of love and a currency of love happens when they transition and become part of our community is, I call them the peanut gallery, because there's a lot of times where, and these are people, I mean, I deeply grieve for still, because I have reverence and veneration for the roles that they've played in my life, but they think it's hilarious because they're in a better place.
They
So
do.
they're jokers, they're, you know, whatever those. And so I love that, this idea of like, you know, putting on this song that we, whatever it is, right? We're grieving or we're trying to raise power. And they're like, that's not what I'm interested in. Like my best friend, they played Buju Banton at her funeral. I mean, it's like that was, and I, that was, for me, that was not what I wanted to hear, right? But that was what she wanted to hear. And I think that's that is why, right? Music and song and dance and raising that kind of power is part of the transmutation of the grief and the heaviness.
For sure.
And I think that's part of, you know, what community brings so beautifully to, you know, many hands make light work. As light workers, I mean, I think that's the thing that I have, you know, it's always the biggest challenge to build community who can carry the weight or hold the edges. And I think that's, you know, as medicine women, that's part of, again, the sharing is in order to find the others. Telling these, you know, healing stories, excruciating stories a lot of the time, that's how we find the community. That's where, you know, whether it's a grief group, whether it's, you know, a retreat, whether it's people come for a reading, whatever those things look like, that can be done in a place of community. I think those things were, you know, traditionally done, you know, but I call them the uninvited, but in organized religion, right? And I think that's grief at least in my experience, doesn't get properly handled in organized religion.
No.
And I think, that's the long con job, unfortunately. And I think, talking about somebody like Jesus of Nazareth, right? I mean, he was a death doula, he was a, a witch, a shaman, and those kinds of archetypes are, that's what's required in those moments of grief, right? Is going to the desert, taking those moments, processing, and then, coming back into community. And I think those two things are, crucial in healing from, grief and working through grief. And I think grief, people, along with trauma, people think that it's like, oh, and then we're finished grieving. And it's like, that's being a human being on the planet, getting a solid practice for grieving is pretty crucial.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
For
But no one's teaching that, right? I mean, obviously we're doing our best,
Yeah.
but in terms of like organized society, which is why it's crumbling.
Absolutely. I mean, like this podcast, it started with sort of me talking about my mom, my experiences feeling through like those feelings on the podcast. But then all of a sudden, I'm like going way, 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 way back, right? And connecting all these little terrors, right? All these little deaths that I've been grieving. So it's a spider web. I'm curious about, so the card I pulled yesterday from your deck, What We've Forgotten, was Vision Quest. So I'm curious what you think about the vision, the importance of the vision quest in the grief journey.
It's just coming off of one. I mean, I think I'm one of those people that those are holy days. So I mark those days because I believe that the veil is thinner on days of birth and days of transition. So, and again, I don't know where I got that from. That just seems to be some knowledge of my soul. And since my best friend passed away, I always take that day. It's just always been a part of the practice. So, and would I call them vision quests? Yeah, I think so. So typically, with especially leaning into the shamanic, component, and we've done some journey work together, but being in a state of shamanic journey where essentially, and what that means is, for those who've never experienced a shamanic journey, it's sort of like being in an active dream, or seeing underwater. And the reason I like to take those dates, of transition and, birth to do vision quests are the veil is thin and for me, what I like to do is do more archaeological work for meaning, right? And I mean, my best friend's been gone, 30, almost 30 years, and I could name what's gone on those 30 days of ceremony, I think part of what, and we started by talking about this idea of airplane mode. I think I learned that. My grandmother passed on May 18th, 2017, and so I was at her bedside with my mom, and we walked her forward. That story's in the book, but part of grieving with my own, the depth of oh, that, I love that that
I
light,
know, right? I was like, oh, okay, all right, y'all. I see
it
you.
flickered and then it went out.
Yeah, the lights just flickered in Amy on Amy's side and then just went out.
Yeah, thanks to my grandmother. So for me, the grieving began as I started to do my healing work when she was alive and naming my trauma as a child with her, which I thought would kill her. And when I named it, she said, me too. So it was this zoom out that had happened while she was still alive of me realizing, and I always say it ran in the family until it ran into me, but I didn't know how much that was true until she shared that with me. And then, of course, the 10,000 foot view of the whole thing being that, my mother was raised by a childhood sexual abuse survivor. I'm a childhood sexual abuse survivor. And it was my mother and I who walked my grandmother forward. And For most survivors, we fear the abuser. So being able to be there with my grandmother and have my mother and I, who, and by that point, I had faced my father, I had called him to account, the truth was out. And my grandmother got to see that. But what was so beautiful was my mother and I literally shamanically, like handing my grandmother back to spirit and knowing that there wasn't any fear because there was no gap for any abuser to make their way into consciousness as she walked home. So that beauty of the grief work also being healing work, it changed the way that I do those vision quests every year because there was such a holiness and, I'm still learning, right, about the depths of connection within my family and what I'm doing here. But it gave me such purpose that, again, as much as, we want to avoid trauma or say we wish these things didn't happen, I was born to walk her forward. So that helps to give a foundation to the grief, right? I think without doing the energetic community work, the soul searching, the vision quest work, it's really difficult to have the perspective of what trauma, may mean. And I think, and obviously it's the last thing anybody wants to hear when you're going through trauma is, there's going to be a meaning to this. And it's like, I don't want to hear that, right? I'm in my trauma. But the excavation, right, of those moments reveals great treasure, I think. And that's been my experience is that, when you do go into turning off the notifications and being in a vision quest or in a spiritual state, the lens becomes much clearer.
Oh, I love that. The lens becomes much clearer. So I feel like that brings us to what we've forgotten. Because that is a very clear lens to and a tool to help to reframe. So I'd love to hear like how that came to be.
Thank you. Well, I think I was born to translate what, I think a lot of the ideas and what we've forgotten aren't new ideas. It's a collection of both stories, rituals, and a guided tour through a temple of wonder. So I always knew, and I'd always written, I'd always created. But I think my trauma, the loss of my best friend, going through the experiences that I'd had, with my father, I created a character, which was the character that I let everyone else see in business. And, I did these things, and people didn't know that I was a creator. Most people didn't know I was a writer. They knew I was an executive producer, which a lot of people don't see as being creative. The artist that I worked with knew that I was creative, but I hid it because it was such a vulnerable place. So I stopped writing when my best friend passed away. And I wrote for clients, I wrote here and there. But I had not thought that I would ever come out of the closet with my creativity. It felt too dangerous. And then, just like training in shamanic healing, which was not something that I thought I would do. I thought I was walking a healing journey and that I was going to do my own work. I never thought I would be called to practice. So the book was very much a similar way. I thought I was going to write a book about, a memoir. And of course, it didn't end up being a memoir. It is a it's a walk through a temple. So the journey begins with you being invited to remember, and you meaning the reader, and we walk on a path of remembering, and we walk, and it's called an interdimensional adventure because all of the locations in the book, they are places that exist in consciousness. So I've gotten a lot of amazing, notes from readers saying, "How did you know the place where I go in my consciousness?" And I'm like, "I went there too." So I think the The book turned into what people keep telling me is also almost like a game, which I, grew up working in digital media, so that's not a big surprise, but it is, it's an act of meditation, and it starts with really a reset about what do we actually know. And so the book begins with, because I think in order to remember, we need to look at what are we coming in with. So there's a lot of consent in the book about, starting the adventure, being on the adventure, and then there's active rituals, and essentially it's a temple of remembering, not just for the things that I've, walked through in my life and how I've transmuted them, but looking at your own story, looking in the mirror, looking at the reclamation of spirit and authentic power, and doing that through a clear lens, as you said, of, what do we know? What is the science, right? How does this work? And I think for me, especially with the shamanic piece, I remember Sandra Ingerman, who's one of my teachers, and read one of the first drafts of the book, which I'm mortified because I feel like I asked her to read my diary. And she did. But what she had said about it was, is this a book about shamanism? And of course, I hadn't answered her. And then she emailed me back. She was like, you already answered me. And I was like, yeah, of course it is. Because I think life is about shamanism. And I think, for me, being able to actually, look into the Akashic records or the spiritual filing cabinet, as I like to call it in the book, to figure out, what are the origins? What are we doing here? And I think, we've tried to answer that question for a long time, but I don't think there's ever been, a handbook. And I tried to write a handbook because it's what I needed. And realizing that throughout my own healing journey and my own creative practice, that I had come up with a format. So that is what we've forgotten. It is a book of remembering. And I open the book by talking about my remembering of my own trauma, and then we don't really talk about it again. We talk about, all of the amazing magic and stories that come out of spiritual practice. And I think that's, how I see shadow work, right? It's essentially it's a mandatory part of light work. But how much time we spend there is completely up to us. And I like to have those times scheduled.
Absolutely. And I just grabbed the book just to see like my notes here, some of the notes that I have in the book. And I think I took some pictures and sent you like some of the things that I have
I love that everyone highlights
highlighted.
it, treats it like a textbook, and it's like, I'm so grateful.
Page 13 says, you have to empty yourself of everything you know in order to learn. And today's card was conception. And then there was just some other great cards that followed it. But for me, the takeaway was that people have to like reimagine their birth story, and that they're actually being here on the planet is a miracle. So just like you said, they have to empty themselves about whatever they've told themselves about the circumstances surrounding their death and just be like, you know what? I'm supposed to be here. I'm the miracle. Right? So,
And
yeah.
I think that that's the idea of really, excavating our own pieces instead of doing what I think, culturally a lot of people have been doing for the last 20 years, which is looking at other people on reality TV, and excavating other people's stories. And it's like, that's not where the magic is, right? That's not, I mean, that's entertaining for sure. And it's like I always call it legal gossip, right? It's those people are they are totally subscribing to being gossiped about by
That's
being on
right.
TV. But the other side of it is, our origin stories, our own journeys are that's the magic and wonder, and that's the adventure that goes on when we leave here. And I always,
That was the second card, by the way, was adventure.
But I think that was a very Pee-wee voice. But yeah, I think that there is, we are on a big adventure, to borrow from Paul Rubens, my dear friend. But I think that's, this idea of, and that was someone else who's transmuted their story. The documentary comes out this week about him. But I think this idea of, taking trauma and transmuting it to power and adventure. And I think Joseph Campbell, did that in the hero's journey.
Yeah, absolutely.
But all of us have a hero's journey.
Absolutely.
And I think instead of, and listen, being in the muck is part of life, right? If you're in
Yeah.
the muck right now and you're listening to this, that's okay. If you
Yeah.
need to go out of the muck, and you're tired of being there, there's amazing resources out there, but being in the muck is part of the journey,
It's
right?
part of the hero's journey.
That's part of where we learn, how much we don't want to be there. And I think getting stuck is, it's its own origin story, right? So it's its own superhero origin story. So I think that's the kind of we can reclaim these moments of ceremony or vision quests or going to the desert. And the funny thing for me, I talked about, I didn't know whether people would accept this, in my life from a business standpoint. Nobody has any problem with it, right? So I had told myself for years, right, that it wasn't safe to be out of the closet as an alchemist or about my trauma or about, and that couldn't have been further from the truth. So, and I think that's part of, again, that searching for that meaning, right? Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning, this idea of looking for the treasures in the trauma.
And so Joseph Campbell, Hero with a Thousand Faces, is a great reference. And this hero's journey, I mean, harkening back to the beginning of the conversation where we talked about Star Wars, great depiction of Wizard of Oz. Like most of the movies that we absolutely love, they chart this hero's journey, right? So what's next for you on this journey?
Oh,
What's your next
I'm
adventure?
excited because I think I had, again, being a human being on this planet, sometimes we are good at giving ourselves limitations that don't exist. And I had told myself, I was going to write this book and then I was just going to do healing work alone and I wasn't going to do creative work anymore. And of course, that was not true at all. So I'm back in the seat as an EP, executive producer, which has been beautiful because part of the book was taking back the rights. So Lunch just took back the rights to the book and the work. And so that's pretty exciting. And in doing that, have been able to, recirculate with all of the artists that I've worked with for the past, 15, 20 years, as well as a lot of new creators and artists, and now weaving this all together. So we're working on some pretty cool stuff in terms of events, in real life, building community, and really looking at new ways of being in terms of economy. I think that's, something that I'm really excited about is, I've been in business for a long time. I just did air quotes. But returning to business with more emphasis on social enterprise, more emphasis on integrating, the actual healing work that all of the artists do into the work that we produce. So I'm excited about that. There's a lot of amazing stuff happening in the network, and I'm so grateful that me, coming back with rights returned was seen by my artists as being like, oh, great, you're back. Here's all the stuff we're doing. So, which has been beautiful, because I think, I had taken a sabbatical to write the book, and, the artists are letting me know that the sabbatical is over. So I'm grateful, and I'm still doing a lot of healing work and working. I love working with creators and trauma survivors, which, isn't a surprise. Those two are often the same thing.
How can people support your work?
You can find me at amymiranda.com. You can find me at thisislunch.com, and you can purchase my audiobook, my book, my oracle deck. You can book a session with me, or you can hire me to make stuff.
Yeah, Amy can make anything, literally.
That's true. Thank you. Except for I'm not very good at cooking. So
Oh, okay.
other than that, I can handle it. So
Okay. Yeah, we need some more witch weekends where we cook
yes.
communally.
Yes. So yeah, and retreats. I'm really excited
No,
about.
yeah. We gotta get, yeah, these retreats, we gotta do that.
Yes, exactly. So that's a spoiler alert for everyone. Retreats events are coming. I think real world work and community is where we need to be. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, Ashe. And so I always like to close with two questions. What are you grieving And what are you grateful for right now?
Oh, what am I grieving? I mean, right now, I think I'm grieving the end of the publishing journey that I had. I mean, it was a very interesting, this isn't, I think any creator who has been commissioned to do something knows what this is like. And so to be able to reclaim and sort of to bring those rights back, I'm definitely, I'm grieving what was, but excited about that rebirth. And I think that's, definitely why I think vision quests are such a, crucial part of any creative process, is to be able to look at how we're transmuting those things. And then I'm excited about all of the connective tissue that came out of that publishing journey. It was, what a beautiful adventure, and what an incredible rising of the tide. With just, I mean, there's, yeah, I'm surrounded by an incredible amount of global creative thinkers, and I don't think that would have happened without the grieving journey.
Well, I mean, this podcast is partly a result of the journey we went on. We did the journey on the 21st, and this podcast was started on the 25th of March.
Pointing that out.
I have to point that out.
And that was, I mean, there was a lot of magic that moved through, and I think
Right?
you on that little bike, we talked about us in the 80s, and it's like that is such a key part of, I think, what you do, right? And what you do in your practice, and finding the others, and then it's like this incredible bike ride, right? On together. It's like ET without the guys that come and take
Totally.
ET.
Totally like ET.
ET stays with us.
Yeah, absolutely. And then what are you grateful for? I mean, I feel like you answered it, but
I'm so grateful for that connective tissue, right? I'm grateful for the community that is, because I think we all are in search of community, right? I mean, that's what we're doing all is finding these new, pathways and forging these new. My teacher always says, when you're a pioneer, you just have the machete, and you're clearing pathways. And I think that's what I'm grateful for right now, is all these people around me, these people, including yourself, with machetes, right? Clearing new pathways. And I'm excited. I don't think, if I wouldn't have gone through my experiences with bringing the book to life, I don't think that I would have been, in such great community.
We've got talk about merch. We've got our machetes and lunch boxes ready to go. Let's go.
I always say Jesus carried a wand and a whip, so it's similar. It's like you want a lunchbox or a machete. We've got
Yeah,
both,
we've got
right?
both. We've got whatever you need.
Hired guys.
Well, this was so good. You'll have to come back on again.
It was so good. Thank you for having me. I just sang a little Bruce Springsteen there because we talked
Oh.
about hired guns. This gun's for hire. You
Hey.
know I was dancing in the dark.
Ooh, maybe that's the title.
It is
Oh.
dancing in the dark.
Maybe that's the title of this
It is.
episode. Dancing in the Dark. Fierce Rebels shows. Oh, yes, that's the title. Amy, again, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Yes. So next week on Come to the Brink, we're talking with Elise Moore Orby. She is a leader in the domestic violence movement whose own grief journey profoundly reshaped her life. Elise is going to share the story of losing the love of her life to cancer, navigating that deep loss, and courageously pivoting careers after decades of transformative advocacy work. It is going to be a powerful conversation. You will not want to miss it. So don't forget to like, share, and subscribe. Come to the Brink. Episodes drop every Tuesday at 7:11 a.m. EST. And of course, you can find us wherever you find your podcast. And if anything that you heard today touches you in any way, text me like you all have been. DM me. And please reach out and let me know what's going on with you, because as I always say, no one deserves to stand on the brink alone. I am Zoe Flowers, and I will see you next time. Bye.